The head of the UN nuclear watchdog says a team is on its way to inspect the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant.
The mission is called the Support and Assistance Mission. We don't know how many people are involved in the mission or indeed when it will arrive.
Plus, Ukraine says its forces have breached Russian front lines in the Kherson region. And later in the program, as Russia's war with Ukraine continues, how effective have sanctions been?
And I think imposing strict sanctions will actually alter Russia's behavior in the long term, but the short term impact might be, you know, quite mixed.
Today is Monday, August 29th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. The International Atomic Energy Agency says that the day has come for the organization's support and assistance mission to depart for and inspect the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is also Europe's largest. VOA's Henry Ridgewell joins me with the details.
Yes, that's right. There's little detail, partly because there's so much yet to be worked out about this visit by the IAEA inspectors to Zaporizhia. The mission is called the Support and Assistance Mission. We don't know how many people are involved in the mission or indeed when it will arrive. And of course, that's because of the very precarious security situation in the region. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant sits on the banks of the Dnieper River. Russia took that power plant in the early days of the war in March and has been in control of it since, but it's still very much a live conflict zone and part of the region that Ukraine wishes to take back from the invading Russian forces. All we know so far is that the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, has tweeted that it's on its way. We don't know where they're setting off from. Presumably there's a team that has been assembled and they will try to work their way through, but they're going to either have to cross from Russian controlled territory to Zaporizhia or have to cross the front lines from Ukrainian controlled territory. We don't know in which direction they're going to come, how their security is going to be worked out, or indeed how long they're going to spend there. So we wait and see, and we don't know yet when they will arrive.
And Henry, you know, as you mentioned, this plant has been under Russian control since March of this year. And there have been a number of concerns, most recently those fires nearby the plant that temporarily decoupled it from the Ukrainian power grid, which is needed to safely operate the plant. What can you tell us about what the IAEA is saying their chief concerns are?
Right, that's the main concern that the IAEA inspectors will be looking at. There are, of course, major fears of a direct hit by a shell or a missile on the plant itself. Ukraine and Russia accuse each other of firing on the plant. But many experts say the containment wall of the reactor, the containment building itself, is so thick at nearly 2 meters that actually that's not the biggest danger. The bigger danger, and that was hinted at in recent days, is that the power to the cooling system will be cut off. Currently, it's connected to Ukraine's national grid, and that supplies power to the cooling systems. Fires last week led to that power connection being cut and the backup generators kicked in to renew the cooling system. But what if those generators failed, or what if the cooling system failed, or some of the coolant liquid leaked out? So these are the major questions they'll be looking at. Of course, if that happened, there would be no cooling system for the reactors. And then we're looking at a melting of the reactor core and then those sort of nightmare scenarios of some kind of nuclear incident. But many aspects that these inspectors will be looking at in a very difficult, very dangerous conflict situation.
From London, VOA's Henry Ridgewell. Henry, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Steve. All the best.
Russian and Ukrainian authorities welcomed the announcement that the IAEA would visit the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant while renewing accusations against one another that the other party was shelling the plant. In a call with reporters on Monday, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that Russia waited a long time for the IAEA mission to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant and that Moscow considers the visit necessary. And speaking in Stockholm, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba called on Russian forces to leave the facility.
Russia is trying to legitimize its presence and to root itself there, but it goes against nuclear safety and also about against the energy security in Europe as a whole for Russia to stay there. Russia must go.
Meanwhile, Ukraine says that its forces have penetrated the front lines of Russia in the Kherson region. Joining us from Kyiv is reporter Anna Chernikova.
Natalia Huminuk, who is a spokeswoman of the Operational Command South of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, confirmed that the Armed Forces of Ukraine have launched offensive actions in many directions in the south of Ukraine. But at the same time, she emphasized that the operation should be completed first before any details will be revealed or any results will be reported. Also, she added that any military operation requires silence, so she is asking not to inform before the operation is done, because there are a lot of information in the public chats of the region. So she's asking not to report anything. However, Ukrainian military also confirmed that Ukrainian forces cut Russian forces completely. In terms of equipment supply to the Kherson region and manpower supply to the Kherson region from Crimea. This was confirmed early in the morning today. At the same time, we also have information from the Ukrainian military that Ukrainian troops broke through the first line of defense of the Russian forces in the Kherson region. And also this was confirmed in the morning before this announcement by the operational command south. Also, we hear just recently that Ukrainian forces attacked the Berislav plant in the Kherson region. And this place was a place where Russian forces kept the equipment and manpower. So certain Russian base and reportedly the base was quite big because currently a very huge fire is ongoing there. And we are waiting for the official information about the casualties and damages, which should be available apparently later on.
Anna, thank you very much for the update. Speaking of military bases being hit, I also understand that in Ukraine's northwest, apparently Russian forces have struck a Ukrainian military base.
Yes, it happened over the weekend. It was a shelling of the military infrastructure in the Rivne region, which is northwest, as you correctly said, of Ukraine. The head of the military administration of the region confirmed that four missiles were fired at the military infrastructure facility in the city of Sarny, and about 30 residential buildings and the premises of the Central District Hospital were damaged by the shock wave. According to the head of the military administration, there are no human casualties reported yet. And also, again, it is no detailed information regarding any damages of the military infrastructure.
And Anna, finally, we covered the announced visit by the IAEA to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. But I also understand that the region has seen some renewed hostilities over the weekend.
We hear that the city of Enerhodar itself and other areas of the Zaporizhia region are under very heavy missile attacks. There were missiles hit reported in the city as civilian buildings in different parts of the town were damaged. For the moment, we know about 10 people injured. And we still don't have final information on the scale of damages because it was quite a bad shelling and a lot of damages were reported. Also, another town of the Zaporizhia region, the town of Orikhov, was under the Russian shelling for 14 hours in a row over the weekend. And there is a report of more than 200 hits in the city, in this town. It's not a very big town. So as was reported by the officials, the central part of the city suffered the most, and it is on fire for a long time. We know that 3-year-old boy and 6-year-old girl, brother and sister, were taken to the hospital with injuries, while their mother received a brain injury and it was also hospitalized. And all this is happening just around we can say just around the Parisian nuclear power plant, because this is the same region and this is quite close.
Reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
For additional updates on the war throughout the day, be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Ivana Stradner serves as an advisor to the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Barish Center for Media Integrity. This war has lasted now over 6 months. What do you see as perhaps the greatest potential dangers for Europe now that both Finland and Sweden have petitioned for NATO membership, which is something that Moscow and Russian President Vladimir Putin, you know, really did not want to see an expansion of NATO?
So thank you so much again for inviting me to speak with you today. As per Russia's threats to Europe, I don't think that it has anything to do with NATO. This is typical Moscow rhetorics, and I do not think that Finland and Sweden joining NATO is a serious threat to Russia, because we have seen it from the very beginning that this war has nothing to do with NATO expansion. I'm way more concerned about several other things and what's happening in Europe right now. To begin with, Russia has been weaponizing energy for years. And we might actually see a serious crisis this fall, which might actually contribute to certain changes in how different European countries, particularly Germany, will approach this war. Second thing, Russia has been also weaponizing refugees. And even though, you know, many people, military analysts, always like to focus on Russia's fighter jets and tanks and how Russia is poorly performing in Ukraine. Russia's military strategy towards Ukraine is, in Europe more broadly, is way more holistic. So, for example, how Russia has been weaponizing refugees to Europe. And I'm also very concerned what I observe right now in Africa with the food crisis, because Africa depends a lot on Ukraine grain. And the third thing is what I'm also observing is that this war might actually also cause to destabilize in different parts in European neighborhood. For example, Russia has been also weaponizing secessionist movements in Moldova and Georgia and Bosnia using absolutely the same playbook. And the final thought that I would like to share with you is that I'm very concerned about the rise of far-right movements in Europe. The 2023 in particular and new elections might actually contribute also to further destabilization in Europe and how Europe might actually approach this war in Ukraine.
So as someone who keeps an eye on Russian misinformation, what are you most concerned about as this war continues and there is this spread of misinformation from Moscow and a rise in far-right political parties across the world?
To begin with, I would like to emphasize that Russia is not losing the information war. Maybe Russia is losing on Twitter and when it comes to the narrative of the war in Ukraine, but Russia is successfully waging information war globally. We need to be honest with ourselves. This is the first thing. Second thing is when it comes to, it's not only about, you know, refugees. Russia has been also weaponizing information space around the bioweapons. The United States has had like numerous bio labs in Ukraine and operating. They even accused us of training migratory birds to deliver bioweapons and kill the Russians, to use drones. The most recent disinformation campaign actually came directly from the Ministry of Defense because they argued that the United States created monkeypox as a bioweapon in one of our biolabs in Nigeria. And many people can actually in the West probably laugh about this campaign, but it's quite, you know, successful elsewhere because Russia has been using that to promote their traditional values and to attack directly LGBT groups. And this is also something that I would like to emphasize also when it comes to U.S. Upcoming midterms elections, because Russia has not ceased to influence American politics by polarizing this country, you know, still based on sensitive topics such as gun regulations, or when it comes to racial issues, currently, you know, economic issues. So even in the United States, Russia is still doing its jobs quite successfully on different social media platforms. And when it comes to Russia itself, it's needless to say that Vladimir Putin has been trying to completely destroy the freedom of speech and the freedom of thought inside Russia. Right now, if you, for example, mention even the word war instead of special military operation, you might actually end up in a jail and pay very, very high fines, let alone Russia ban numerous foreign social media platforms. And even for us right now to deliver information inside Russia using Western social media platforms might be challenging, even though there are different ways that they can go around it, for example, by using VPN systems, etc., etc. So number one thing that we really need to recognize is that Russia is using information as a weapon. And second thing is, if you really want to win the information war, we need to counter Russia globally, because Russia is trying to portray the West as a nefarious actor and rally its allies and gain the support outside borders of the Western world. And that is also something very much related to Russia's ideology and promoting further digital authoritarianism along with China.
I wanted to ask you this. EU leaders are about to meet and discuss whether or not to carry out an all-out ban on civilian Russian travel, or at least to significantly reduce the number of travel visas available. Given that, how would you gauge the success of the sanctions imposed on Russia by the United States and its allies since Russia invaded Ukraine back in February?
It depends how you define effectiveness, because if the goal was to stop the war, certainly they haven't achieved something like that so far. And I think imposing strict sanctions will actually alter Russia's behavior in the long term. But the short-term impact might be, you know, quite mixed. So we need to be patient about this thing. The second thing is, even though the import collapsed, the problem was also, you know, with Russia was quite, you know, successful with exports of oil and gas at the beginning of the war. But if you, for example, take a look at the manufacturing of automobile and other goods related to that, I think, and for example, airlines, they completely started almost banning flights, because they need the parts that are missing in the Russian economy that they cannot replace for waging the war. So it depends really how you define the success of sanctions. Even when it comes to, as I said, you know, the imported parts that they need for their weapons, that's also something that we should, I think, target specifically. Whether banning places such as IKEA or McDonald's can alter the behavior of the Russians, I doubt. If there is one thing that the Russians are good at, it's really suffering. So I'm not actually sure whether banning different fashion brands or McDonald's can alter the behavior of Russia. But the only way I think that we can stop this war in the long run, if we really hurt the Russians where it hurts most, and that is specifically we should specifically target Russia's parts that they use for waging the war. And the third thing is, we also need to be honest with ourselves, you know, how Russia is using different places to evade sanctions. And that's something because Russia is still operating outside of Russia with different companies. For example, they recently even moved companies to a tiny place such as Serbia to evade sanctions, let alone in other parts of the globe. So that's also something that we should bear in mind when it comes to the effectiveness of sanctions.
The United States and other nations have also directly sanctioned various individuals, Russian oligarchs, who have close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. How about the effectiveness of those sanctions?
I think we should have done it, you know, a long time ago, but this is what it is, and we are where we are. Targeting specifically individuals closer to Putin is a step in the right direction. Whether at this point they will alter the behavior of Putin, I'm not sure about that. But nevertheless, I think along, you know, with the traveling visa bans and sanctioning oligarchs, I think it's a step in the right direction. At least it's sending a serious signal to the world, you know, that there are certain values.
Ivana Stradner is an advisor for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Speaking at an oil and gas conference in Norway via video link, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Monday that Russia is trying to prevent European nations from filling their gas storages enough to cope with the coming winter. His comments come as Russia's Gazprom plans maintenance this week that will halt gas flows along the Nord Stream 1 pipeline that links Russia and Germany via the Baltic Sea. Also, UN officials report that they are unable to provide humanitarian aid to millions of people in Russian-controlled areas of eastern Ukraine, putting those people's lives and well-being at risk as winter approaches. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Since Russia invaded Ukraine 6 months ago, UN and private aid agencies have been able to provide critical humanitarian aid to more than 12 million people despite the security risks. However, only 1 million have been reached in Russian-controlled areas in eastern Ukraine during this period. The UN humanitarian coordinator in Ukraine, Denise Brown, says aid agencies have no reliable way to cross the front line and distribute aid to the many destitute people in need.
We regularly do not succeed in getting the security guarantees that we require from the Russian Federation in order to go across that front line. We do have staff in those areas, and the staff in those areas confirm that there are acute humanitarian needs.
Speaking from Kharkiv, 20 kilometers from the front line, Brown says Ukraine's long, hard winter is just around the corner. She says she worries conditions for people living across the front line will get worse. She says a key focus of UN plans for the winter months is figuring out how to deliver and distribute aid to communities in these hard-to-reach places.
We will have to work differently here. What's required, and again, the authorities I've met in the past few days, people need windows repaired, they need doors repaired, they need common heating services. There's a lot of old people in rural communities. Can we work with small volunteer organizations to ensure that they're being checked on during the winter months?
She says it is her job, not that of the UN staff on the ground, to negotiate with the Russian authorities for access to the area. However, she says the staff serves an important protection function by their mere presence. She says they can monitor conditions and inform the UN about the well-being of the people and their needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with all the latest developments, not only in Ukraine, but around the world. You can do so at voanews.com as well as on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.